I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Being a member of a group can lead to great things. Cooperation, sacrifice, generosity. We see it all over the world. It can also lead to scapegoating and violence. History is full of examples of hate-fueled mob behavior. In-groups can create out-groups, a sense of us versus them. Our guest, social psychologist Jay Van Bavel, says that our identity, beliefs, and behavior are shaped by the groups we identify with and are a member of. This sense of belonging goes way back to our ancient ancestors who relied on their close-knit communities for their survival. Today's social media can bring us together and drive us apart. Exhibit A, how a false Facebook post about Haitians eating household pets in Springfield, Ohio, was pushed by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance as part of their political campaign, driving hatred and fear of immigrants. It's a worrisome development and a window into the power of group psychology. Jay Van Bavel is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University and affiliate at the Stern School of Business and Management and Organizations. He's also director of the Social Identity and Morality Lab and co-author of a book titled The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities to Improve Performance, Increase Cooperation, and Promote Social Harmony. And Jay Van Bavel, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to the Serengeti, to our ancient ancestors who were trying to survive, you know, in a very harsh environment. Can we say that belonging and the power, the need to be part of a group, is one of our oldest psychological needs?
Yeah. I mean, so I think of humans this way. You know, we can't fly away. We don't have camouflage or poison or sharp teeth. And so we would have been picked off pretty quickly by predators if we were left on our own. But our evolutionary advantage, what made us, you know, survive, pass on our genes and spread all over the entire world and, you know, even land, you know, in space, is our capacity for cooperation. That's what makes us strong. And so this is one of the reasons why people are terrified of, for example, public speaking, because they're worried about embarrassing themselves in front of everybody. Some people fear public speaking more than death itself. And the reason for that is because they are the ancestors of generation after generation after generation of people who cared about belonging and were able to fit in. And so that's why things like social exclusion are so upsetting to us as humans, because we want to fit in so we can survive and so that we can, you know, cooperate and work together to solve problems.
I think it's also interesting that we're talking about, of course, human beings, that would be you, me, and everyone listening to us, that we have a need to belong, to be part of a group, but we also have this need to be unique, to be uniquely us. Do you see those in contradiction?
Yeah, so they're often in contradiction because you want to belong, but you want to be distinctive. And so groups that scratch both those itches are uniquely appealing. So what we really want, what we really strive for, is to be part of a group that's special. And so this is why if you go to major university websites, one of the first things they show is how many people they reject, how hard it is to get in, because that's a symbol, if you're a member of that group, that you're somehow special. Or if you go to like a club and there's like the velvet rope and everybody's waiting outside, if you can get in, you're kind of inside that community. And so that's something that all of us want in one way or another.
Can we say that our first group is our family? I mean, obviously, our family has such an important influence on our lives, on our survival, on our behavior, our personality.
Yeah, for most of us, that's the core group, you know, the core unit that we spend time with. But of course, as you get older, especially adolescents care also, and I have a couple teenage kids, they care deeply about like fitting in with kids their age, and they actually start to assert their independence from their family to ensure that they're like well connected and fit in the community of kids that they care about at school.
You say, and I think we know this, that we are, when it comes to our identity, we're not one thing. We are many things, and we're often different things and different people depending on the other people that we are with. And you even have this kind of a, I won't say it's a game, but I guess it's a questionnaire, I am dot, 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 dot. And how we fill that in tells us a lot about who we are.
Yeah. So one of the key things about human nature is we're not just part of one group, we're part of many. And so we like the quote from the poet Walt Whitman, who said, you know, I contain multitudes. So I'm talking to you and your audience right now as an author of a book. As soon as I get off this call, I'm a professor. I have to meet my students. When I get home, I'm a father and I'm thinking about how to get dinner for my kids and help them with their homework. When they go to bed, maybe I'm watching like my favorite sports team, a hockey team or a football team, and I have a whole other identity. And so, in a given day, as we go from one situation to the next, different identities are triggered, and that changes how what we think about, what our goals are, who we feel connected to or distant from. And so that's something that's embedded within us. We're not just a single individual person. We are actually part of all kinds of communities, and that shapes how we think about ourselves and who we really are, what our sense of self is and our identity is.
And it changes over time as we age. We have a different identity. We're viewed differently in the world as well.
Yeah. And people, the other thing is if we have a visual cue to our identity, that changes how people treat us. So people judge us based on our gender or our race or our age. Those are the three big ones. But they might see that we're wearing a certain color. So if you're in like a gang territory in some city, whether you're wearing like red or blue can signal whether treat you pe people treat you very well or with respect, or you're under threat and it's a dangerous environment for you. And this is one of the things people do, for example, on social media. Is more and more research is finding that people will signal their political identity in their bio on social media. And they're trying to send out like a bat signal to social media, to others, to signal who they're with and who they're against. And we do this in all kinds of different ways, but that's something that people regularly do. They want to signal what team they're on.
Which takes us back to our ancient beginnings, right? It's just happened so much faster on social media.
And we can do it at great scale on social media, and with great clarity because it's easy to show a symbol. You know, you can see people put flags whether they support Ukraine or not, or in Gaza whether they support Israel or Palestine. People are very actively trying to signal to huge audiences. And what this does is it signals to people that, you know, if you agree with me, you can follow me, you can support me, we can connect, we share something in common, but it also can signal to other people that maybe you're going to be hostile to them or threatening to them.
The United States is often described as a highly individualistic culture. We've got this kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps mythology or mentality. We honor individual achievement. I don't know how much that sets us apart from the rest of the world, but is something that's said about us as a country. How do you see that fitting in with this sense, this need, this desire to belong?
Yeah, so there's a couple interesting things. So first off, you're spot on that Americans are much more individualistic than, say, people in Japan or other countries. But one of the interesting things is being individualistic is part of what it means to be part of the identity of American, which is a group. And so when you have immigrants join America, the more they start to get assimilated and integrated and identify with America as a country, the more they start to become individualistic in their own sense of identity. So it's kind of funny that we think of ourselves as, you know,
Right.
you hear the term everybody's being sheep except for me. But even that thought that you are an individualist is partly because you're a sheep. You're conforming to the norms of the group that you care about and identify with. And so that's kind of the funny thing about Americans. And, you know, they think they're individualistic, but their individualism is part of how they conform
Right.
to the culture that they're in.
Yeah. Well, people are complicated, right? I think we can all agree on that. It's interesting you said, you know, you're a sports fan. I'm down here in Philadelphia, so obviously people are Eagles fans or Phillies fans or 76ers fans. And I always find it interesting with sports fans is that sports fans will say, you know, we're number one. And I always think, yeah, but you're not on the field or on the court. You're in the stadiums or at home watching on your TV. You are not playing there, but you feel this identification that you know, I am a member of this team.
Yeah, there's something interesting that happens. One of my favorite studies was done in the 1970s at college campuses in the Midwest where there's these big football programs. So I was at Ohio State University for several years, and that the local religion is Buckeyes football there. So they get 100,000 people or more every game they have. And so, and you see all these people identifying. And so they went into the classrooms on the Monday after the game, which was on Saturday, and the researchers counted how many people were wearing the colors of the local college football team in their classrooms. And what they see is that after a team wins, everybody is much more likely to wear like a hat or a jersey or colors or some symbol of the team. And when they called people to ask them, you know, about if they watched the game and how it went, after a team wins, people are more likely to show those colors and more likely to use the word we.
Wow.
We won. All of a
Wow.
sudden, even if they're just watching from home, they're part of the we. And if the team loses, the same people will say, Oh, they lost. You know, all of a sudden they're not, they don't identify with the, that's the football players on the field that lost. That's not me. And so our identity changes, even whether the team we're related to does well or not. We identify more when they're winning, and we disidentify with them a lot more when they lose. Although I will say there's some hardcore fans that it doesn't matter whether
No, it
they're at the
doesn't.
game
Right.
or at home by themselves, and they're, you know, it's one of the moments where you'll, it's socially acceptable for like grown men,
To be
40,
crying, right?
50, 6 year olds to be bawling in there, and you know, and it's when their team loses or loses in the playoffs, they're sitting at home on their couch by themselves, crying like a baby. And so that's about how deep their connection is to the team and the deep their identity is.
But it does tell you how strong the group is, I guess, to or the team or whatever the, you know, whatever the thing is that you identify with, how powerful that is to shape behavior. How does that work?
Yeah, so the first part of it is that once you identify with a group, and we're talking about sports teams here, 'cause, but it could be your national country when we were watching
Sure.
the Olympics a few months ago, or it could be like going to your local kids, like, you know, sporting event at the local school. You're starting to see the world differently. You're paying attention to different things. You're often looking more towards members of your group, whatever the group is at that moment. You're cheering for them more. You always think the refs are biased against you, because you're interpreting ambiguous things in your favor, and therefore you think everybody else is biased. That you start to have a goal that you want, you adopt the group's goals instead of your own selfish goals because you want the team to win. And if you're part of the team, you're going to make sacrifices to help them win. And so all of these things change our behavior, and they also change how we treat other people. If we're at the game and you're next to another fan wearing the same jersey, it doesn't matter if they're a stranger who you'd otherwise completely ignore on the street. You're now giving them high fives and fist bumps and cheering with them. And if they're wearing the team of the opposite jersey, it's awkward. And they might be teasing you or harassing you. And in rare cases, it even spills over into threats. Or I was at a college football game in Lehigh with my co-author Dominic, and it was Lehigh Lafayette. And that's the oldest football rivalry in the country. And we even saw some fans coming to blows at the football game, like punching each other, and they had to get carted out by the security. So these things can spill over into the real harsh discrimination and mistreatment of people on the other side that we would normally be perfectly friendly with.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. I've got lots of more questions for you, Jay Van Bavel, and he is the director of the Social Identity and Morality Lab at New York University. As I mentioned, he's the co-author of a book titled The Power of Us. And we're talking about the power of belonging, of the power of groups to both bring us together, what groups can do to pull us apart, how it can lead to conformity and shape our identity. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking about belonging. It's a powerful need for all of us human beings. Our social world shapes our beliefs, our behaviors, our identity. And again, our guest is psychologist Jay Van Bavel. And he wrote a book recently called The Power of Us. He co-authored the book, and it has given us a lot to talk about when it comes to human behavior and the power of groups. Let me pick up on something you were talking about right before the break, Jay, about sports teams, but it also leads to this issue of conformity where people begin to believe and act the same kind of way. Picking up on that, I wonder how then groups create kind of in groups and out groups. The other, you know, I'm the good group, you're the bad group. How that can lead to problems.
Yeah, the most striking thing about this is that all it really takes is a flip of a coin. And so there's very famous research from 1970 where researchers wanted to figure out what causes discrimination. Is it like a history of conflict, you know, stereotypes, you know, fighting over resources or power? And so they got rid of all of those things And they created two groups by basically random assignment, of these kids, these teenage kids, to two different teams. And what they found is, even if you didn't even know anybody in your team or know anybody on the other team or know anything about them, the fact that you were simply part of their group and had something in common with them led you to discriminate against the other group. You gave less money and less resources to them and more to your members of your own team. And that has been found in many, many studies. I have actually found that myself in many studies in many countries. And so it is something that seems to be part of, again, part of our DNA, going back to the origins of this, is that the moment that the situation signals we're part of one group or another, it triggers a mentality of I'm going to privilege and advantage my own group. There are things that we can do to reduce that, but that seems to be the default switch.
I mean, it sounds like we're almost hardwired to, then to be, if not racists, to discriminate against people that feel like they're not part of our team.
Yes, exactly. And so, in some countries where there's a history of racial divisions and racism and racist conflict, people, when they're young, they learn that that's the division of us versus them. But in other countries, it's based on religion or where you grew up or your caste or what team you cheer for. And, if you go to like soccer crazy nations, all of these things can be the things that trigger that sense of us and them. And so we have to think very carefully about the culture we create because we're sending signals to all kinds of people, including little kids, that will trigger whether or not they are going to treat other people equally or discriminate against them.
You mentioned it's as simple as flipping a coin, how people identify. In terms of trying to bridge these divides, is it also a flip of a coin, or is it more complicated than that?
Yeah, it can be more complicated, but what we have found in my studies, this was my PhD dissertation. You just talked about racism, and racism can be very automatic, almost like a reflex for many people because it's so ingrained through the media and culture. And I found that simply by putting people on a mixed race team, changed how they treated them. They liked them more, and it didn't matter what race they were. They discriminated against the other group, the other race, far less. And this happened. We put them in an MRI scanner and looked at their brain, and their brain started treating people differently. Their emotional systems were responding just to anybody who's part of my group, and it didn't matter what team they were on. Their visual system was responding also to who's a member of my group, and it didn't matter what race they were. And so these are the things that happen to us very quickly, and it has a cascading effect all the way from the way that we see people and who we look at to how we treat them and how we feel about them.
I mean, that's meaningful contact. It goes back to this idea of integration, right? If you get people, different people together, and they begin to mix it up with each other, they might end up being friends or getting married.
I mean, intergroup contact is the oldest and one of the most effective strategies we have for getting rid of discrimination of all kinds. The key thing is you have to have them cooperate and work together towards something, and ideally be of similar or equal status. If you have them where one group is higher status and mistreats the other group, contact's not going to help. It's only going to make things worse. And you can see this in all kinds of segments of society or all kinds of conflict. So simply bringing people together can help, but it's not enough. You got to do it in a wise way. And there's lots that can be done that can like foster healthier interactions if you do it well.
Let's talk about the level of political polarization. We're obviously in the throes of a presidential campaign, which always makes things more intense and, frankly, more ugly. But has our partisanship gotten worse, gotten more ugly, more intense?
We all feel it, and it's true. So political scientists have tracked how positive we feel to members of our own political party and the other political parties. So Democrats feel about Democrats versus Republicans and vice versa. And we have that data for over 40 years. And essentially what it shows is that people feel pretty similarly positive towards their own parties. And that hasn't changed in 40 years. What has changed is people are feel more and more negative towards the other party. And it now the amount that we hate the outgroup is stronger than the amount that we love our own in-group. And so now a lot of people will vote for a political candidate or a president who they might not even like simply because they think the other side is evil or going to do something terrible to society and they really hate them. And so that is a dangerous thing to have psychologically in people when they hate the other group so much that they're going to vote for someone they don't even like or someone they think is corrupt or a bad leader simply because they despise the other group.
I grew up in the 50s and 60s, so lived through, you know, assassinations and protests and McCarthyism and, you know, the legalized racism and on and on and on. So this was obviously a very fraught political time, but you're saying it's even more negative today.
Yeah, and I'll put it in a historical context. So this country has a long history of racism that you remember. Yep. It's not, you know, it still has a great, there's a lot of racism still, but it was much worse at a time. In fact, it was illegal to marry someone of a different race up until recently in many states. And people despise it. Most Americans in surveys said they don't support, for example, their own kid marrying someone from another race. They would deeply disapprove of it. However, over time, people are far more accepting of interracial marriage. Now, at the same time, we've seen that people don't want their kids to marry someone from a different party. Right. And now that is a stronger opposition that parents have about their kids, you know, dating and relationships and marriage than they have about race. And so when we think of, like, there's still a lot of different forms of racism that are embedded in more economic systems and so forth. But the amount of just sheer animosity towards political parties now outstrips that.
Well, let me talk about this. I mean, it's such I almost hate to raise it and to play clips from it, but nonetheless, it's the moment that we're in. Donald Trump, his vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, are targeting legal Haitian migrants who are living and working in Springfield, Ohio, claiming falsely that Haitians are stealing people's pets and eating them. This is an allegation that has been debunked by the mayor of Springfield, by the governor of Ohio, and many other people, but to no avail. Let me just play a short clip of former President Trump speaking Wednesday at the Nassau Coliseum on Long Island before a crowd of his supporters.
I said, if you let them in, it's going to be hell. They are vicious, violent criminals that are being let into our country. They're people that their countries, who are very smart, they don't want them. And what's happening to our country is we're just destroying the fabric of life in our country, and we're not going to take it any longer, and you got to get rid of these people.
And on and on from there. I should add that he said the word Congo about four or five times, which I think we know what that is code word for. I mean, Jay, we have a long history in this country of hostility to immigrants. Donald Trump has his own long history of hostility to immigrants. And yet we're a nation of immigrants. It's such a strange paradox about how we speak about the other those other people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an immigrant myself, so it feels very personal to me.
I bet.
Yeah, there's a long history of stereotyping and derogating immigrants, you know, from Irish and Italian immigrants, you know, on forward over many, many decades. And it's one way for him to rally his base who's concerned about immigration. But it's a way of scapegoating minority groups and creating these stories that are based on misinformation and continuing to push them after they've been debunked or discredited it makes you reveal that this isn't something about conveying some fact that is well verified. It's about demonizing a certain group of people to mobilize a base that's going to come out and vote for him in the election, and also to kind of make immigration, you know, in every media. So people like you and I spend our time thinking about it and talking about it, and that it, you know, appears at the front page of the newspapers and mm-hmm. on the 5 o'clock news. And so that's the goal, is to make that the centerpiece of the discussion, not other issues like, for example, abortion or his performance in the debate. And so that's a strategy that he's used very well, and he's used it, you know, continuously since he's been running for president over the last 8 years. And also, you know, it's not just him. This is a long American tradition of people who've done this. And so, yeah, it's kind of like the worst part of this aspect of human nature. And he's basically, you know, dehumanizing these people in a way that, like, makes others hate them more. And they're getting, my understanding is, like, death threats and all kinds of terrible things.
Oh, death threats and bomb threats and obviously, you know, a community that is terrified because of things that are being said about it. But it's so worrisome and confounding in a way. So facts don't seem to undo. Obviously, this is something that both Trump and Vance are saying every day, and in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. In fact, the woman that put the original Facebook post out has retracted it and said it's wrong. And I'm sorry I ever did this to my neighbors. But that doesn't seem to be enough to sort of dial it back. And maybe even talking about it on the radio, you know, helps to kind of feed this. But what counters this kind of pernicious lie?
Yeah, so this is something my lab has been studying for the last 8 or 9 years, is why people believe misinformation. And a big factor is partisanship. That if you trust Donald Trump because you identify with him, then you're more likely to believe what he says, and you're more likely to distrust, say, what someone on NPR says or what Kamala Harris says. And the other thing is that you're more likely to want to spread that. And so you spread it in part because you want him to win the election, and you're trying to signal that the, you know, that if Democrats are elected, they won't deal with this issue, and that it's a terrifying issue. And so these are the things that people are politically motivated to do. And some people genuinely believe this. And so our fact checks are actually helpful. But what we have found, I've studied this, is that fact checks work, but when they're these highly partisan pieces of information, they don't work very well. What people believe just tends to be what people like them that they trust say. And so that can be, if you're a Republican, that's going to be other Republicans or other Republican news sources. And so those sources, like Fox News, verifies this, or at least makes it seem plausible. They're far more likely to continue to believe it, even if it's been thoroughly fact-checked. And that's part of the problem of polarization. And we have found, although Republicans are more likely to believe and spread misinformation, we have also found that Democrats are just as susceptible to it. They're just not exposed to it as much. And so this is something that is part of all of us, I think, our potential to want to believe things that benefit and align with our team or our side. And when you're polarized and you lose trust of other people who are on other political parties, that makes it very hard for you to update your beliefs, because you don't trust the sources that are fact-checking the misinformation.
Well, let me play a clip that maybe really underscores the point you just made. This is President Joe Biden. He hosted a reception in celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month at the White House on Wednesday. Here's just a bit of what he said.
Let me be clear. We believe in an immigration system that reflects our values. We don't demonize immigrants. We don't single them out for attacks. We don't believe they're poisoning the blood of the country. We're a nation of immigrants, and that's why we're so damn strong.
And Jay, obviously a lot of Biden and Harris supporters are probably nodding their heads when they hear that. But you're saying someone who truly believes that this is going on and believes it because the people that they are supporting tell them that it's true. What, until Trump and Vance dial that back, this will live on?
Yeah, that's one of the problems, is that, you know, it might decrease. But the most powerful thing that could happen is that Republicans debunk it. Hmm. And what we found is that people are far less likely to spread misinformation if they think people like them find it misleading. And so that means Republicans need to understand that other Republicans find this misleading. The problem is, even if the average Republican doesn't believe this, it's often invisible because they won't speak up. It's awkward if you're a Republican right now to speak up and disagree with it. And so other Republicans aren't going to see the disagreement. Those people will often just bite their tongues and be silent about it. And that's a little bit a problem of, say, the design of social media, where it amplifies the most extreme voices. So a very small number of people account for the most of social media posts. And so you tend to see, you know, people on the far left who are going to be debunking it, and people on the far right who are probably going to be amplifying it or justifying it in various ways. Mm-hmm. And so it is a precarious place if you are, say, an average Republican and you don't trust people on the left, but you're not seeing kind of the moderate Republican person speak out on this and their voice is not being heard. And so we have to find ways to surface those, whether we're thinking about how to design social media or who we can invite on, you know, panels and on TV that is moderate Republicans that other Republicans will trust that can debunk this.
I mean, I should say the Republican governor of Ohio has debunked it. But nonetheless, you raise an interesting point about just the power of the group and to sort of keep people in the fold. And I guess what? The fear of being ostracized, of being kicked out, keeps people silent?
Yes, exactly. Because again, this goes back to group belonging. You know, again, we are the ancestors of generation after generation of people who found a way to fit in. And so there's huge pressure to conform. And you know, it'd be interesting if Mike DeWine, I used to live in Ohio, and he's a very smart, capable governor, you know, a more traditional Republican. And so it's really important for him to speak out against it. But I would not be surprised if he hasn't faced threats and potentially death threats from, you know, Trump supporters in Ohio who don't want him to speak out on this. So it actually is really hard for people like that to speak out.
But
it's also, just to underscore, really important.
Yeah, sure, go ahead. Yeah, and really important. I hear you. Let me quote something that David French wrote in the New York Times this week. He says, one of the things I think that liberals tend to miss about the MAGA movement is that they miss its underlying sense of community and its joy. There is a strong sense of belonging within MAGA, and they have a great time being MAGA. If you're on the outside, you see MAGA as almost entirely an angry movement. And so this idea that it's also a lot of fun and fellowship, that is something you don't see at all. But if you're on the inside of it, it's one of the most dominant characteristics. Do you agree with that? And we have about a minute before our second break here. Go ahead.
Yeah, Jeff. Yeah, I agree completely. Like, he's talking about the psychology of it. And right now we have an epidemic of loneliness that only got worse during the pandemic, and technology only seems to make it even worse. And so being part of a community is something that's really important to people. And we need to find ways to create community that are healthier than, you know, cheering on misinformation about immigrants. But I will say that that's important. And I think that is something I agree with David French, that liberals don't understand. When you see Trump's rallies, people come decked out. It's like almost like you see like Trekkies or something at a comic convention, where they come all dressed up. And these people come with like custom-made shirts and flags and all kinds of things. And it is really like a celebration and a community for them. And it's filling that need for them. And that also is why it's sometimes hard to convince people to change their beliefs. Because when you're asking them to change their beliefs, say about Donald Trump, you're asking them also to, that it's, you know, imagine their neighborhoods, who their friends are, who they're married to, who their family is, who members of their community are, and what it will be like for them if they do change that belief. And so you have to understand that these beliefs are nested within social networks and communities that can be incredibly important to people.
Let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jay Van Bavel. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University. He's also director of the Social Identity Morality Lab. Wrote a book a couple of years ago with his co-author titled The Power of Us. And we are talking about the power of belonging, the power of groups to define our identity, our sense of belonging, our sense of security and safety in the world. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the fact that belonging is a powerful need for human beings. Whether we're a part of a sports team or a member of a political party, our social world shapes our beliefs, our behavior, our identity. Talking today with social psychologist Jay Van Bavel about the upsides and downsides of being part of a group. Jay, I was reading your book yesterday, and there was some interesting research about how people can misjudge things like distances. And if you in any way feel, you know, threats from migrants, let's say coming from Mexico, that you judge Mexico City to be a lot closer to where you live than it actually is. Flesh that out for us.
Yeah, this was research I did with a former student of mine, and we wanted to look at how threats shape perceptions. And we find that people who are threatened by immigration from Mexico, they think it's going to threaten American culture and change it in some negative way. That threat makes kind of Mexico loom larger in their mind. They think that the number of immigrants coming over is a lot larger than it is, and they think Mexico is closer to them. And this is including like people in New York suddenly think that like the Mexican border, Mexico City, are closer to New York. Mm. Or if you're in like, let's say, Kansas or Michigan, suddenly it all seems closer to you. And that's the way that humans adaptively have always dealt with threats. That you, if you're, something is potentially threatening, like you're walking in the woods and you see a snake, you have a system that's designed to help you avoid getting bit. And so you react defensively and automatically. You jump out of the way, your, adrenaline system kicks on. And that is something that's has been adaptive for us throughout survival. And now these are like often symbolic threats and group threats. And it kind of prepares us for action to see them as closer than they are. And but that can be a problem, right? Because it distorts reality, and it can lead to like bad political decisions and misunderstandings of what actually is happening.
So are we, meaning we human beings, are we out of whack with our evolution and our biology that we're reacting to the threat of snakes when most of us are not going to run across snakes in our lives?
Yeah, exactly. So we have these, we have very evolutionarily old brains because our brain evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to solve certain problems and to keep us alive and pass on our genes. And we have very recently developed societies that are much safer, much healthier, much more diverse. We wouldn't have, our ancestors, many of them, wouldn't have seen somebody who looks different from them in terms of like skin tone and language because we didn't have the transportation capacity till the last couple hundred years. And so what that means is that we have these very evolutionarily old brains that are designed to help us survive in a very threatening environment. But you place them in a modern environment and they're misperceiving things. And I don't just want to say like this applies to immigrants or groups. The same thing happens with why we love like fatty and sugary foods and why it's so easy for me, I live in New York, to like just want to gorge on four pieces of delicious pizza.
Of
It's
course.
because my taste buds are designed to find anything that's fatty and eat as much of it as possible because I went, my ancestors lived in worlds where there wasn't very much food. And so if they something that they tasted was sugary or fatty, they ate it quickly as much as they could to survive. And so that stuff tastes better to us because our ancestors who really enjoyed the taste of it were more likely to eat enough to have enough calories to survive. But for us in a world of abundance, it's actually incredibly dangerous, for our long-term health to engage in drastic overeating of these types of foods. But that's and so we get tricked all the time. Marketing is designed to like make us want this stuff even when it's not healthy for us. And so that's the same trickery that happens to our, ancient minds designed to solve one problem placed in a very different environment.
Well, picking up on that, so if we fear things, then we exaggerate the threat that they pose to us. And if we fear things, then talking about the treatment of immigrants or migrants, then we dehumanize them. Are they sort of one and the same?
Yeah, it's a very similar process. So I live in, again, I'll say New York. It wasn't that long ago in the 80s, for example, that New York's crime rate was two or three or four times as high. That's not that far away. It was very dangerous. Now it's one of the safest moments in the history of New York. And so it's in my interest, I'm a researcher to find people to collaborate with who come through the city, who are strangers to me from different backgrounds and different countries. By working with them, I can benefit my research. I can improve science. I can improve my teaching and my mentoring by doing that. If I was terrified of all of them, I would be a terrible professor and have a hard time doing my research. And so it's great that I'm able to understand now that it's safe. But a lot of us are kind of like when we hear stories, these types of stories and misinformation that gets amplified, it leads us to misperceptions about. Most people think crime is increasing and violent crime is increasing, even though it's decreasing. Most people think immigrants, including illegal immigrants, are causing most crime. Actually, their crime rates are far lower. Usually, their crime rates are much lower until they're third generation Americans. And then it kind of comes up to the average level of crime for Americans. And so, I had a colleague who studies immigration and crime, and he said this is like a zombie idea. This idea has been dead that immigration is associated with more crime for years and years and years and years. But it keeps coming around, in part because politicians push this false information over and over again.
In fact, you and others have found, and I think people who've been through crises have found, is that and this is quoting some of the work you've done, is that panic is if something terrible, let's say there's a train wreck or something horrible like that, that the panic is rare and that helping is common, that under, I guess, unusual but adverse situations, many people, or maybe most people, rise to the occasion and help each other.
Yeah, again, this is another misperception of human nature. I would argue it's one of the biggest myths about human psychology is that we're callous and we don't help. But there's great research on bystanders when they see someone in trouble. They're very likely to intervene. And the key often that determines whether they intervene is it someone like them? Is it someone who shares their identity? And there's also research in crises, like including terrorist attacks. you might think every man for himself, everybody just runs and tries to save their own life when there's a bombing going on. But what research finds is that most people are looking to help somebody. If someone else gets injured, they immediately help them. And so it's much more like, I always thought there's this great, I call it the Rogers rule after, you know, Mr. Rogers.
Oh, sure, Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Rogers, and he said when he was a little boy and he would see terrible things in the news, his mom would say, always look for the helpers because there's always someone helping. And it's just a different way of thinking about the world to look for the helpers instead of looking for the selfish people. But it turns out the helpers are far more common than we think. I'll also add to this, it's important to look for the helpers because research finds that if you're cynical, if you think people are not helpful or not cooperative, you're less likely to cooperate and help others, and worse things will happen to you. You'll make worse economic outcomes. You'll end up more likely to be alone and less likely in relationships and have fewer friends. Whereas the people who have this more optimistic view that's actually more accurate about human nature are more likely to have better economic outcomes, have better social outcomes, have better relationship outcomes. So it's important here to tell people the truth so they can have an accurate view of things, because it will also lead to better outcomes for them over the course of their life.
Your description there got me thinking about the fact that we're obviously in this presidential race and the polls are very, very close. They change day to day, but all largely within the margin of error. And yet, when you look at the issues, there is so much more consensus among people of all political persuasions about things like abortion or guns or climate or healthcare, even immigration. So it's an interesting, again, this kind of disconnect when there probably is more agreement. But when it comes down to voting, it seems like it's a lot closer.
Yeah. And this is, again, one of the reasons why I really think polarization is dangerous for society. It splits us into extremes and us versus them rather than trying to find common cause and compromise. And like you said, something like 85% of Americans support some regulations on automatic weapons because
right.
they don't like seeing school shootings in the news all the time and they don't want to live in fear. So most people, even most Republicans, agree. We're not as polarized on abortion as you might think. Like, a lot of people want abortion rights, but they potentially want constraints on extreme cases. Like very late term abortion. And that's a consensus view. Another one is climate change. That's a big one. Super polarized. But nevertheless, the majority of overwhelming majority of Americans believe climate change is real. And they often want some kind of change. And we just ran a study around the world in over 60 countries on climate change. And it's polarized in a lot of countries. America is the second worst, but it's not the worst. And what we found is Republicans and Democrats, people on the right and left, we're just as likely to actually do effortful work to plant trees. So if you can find common ground with people across the political spectrum to do something that they care about, because everybody loves nature, doesn't matter what your political beliefs are, you can actually start to make real change on this. And that's just one thing. And you might say, well, planting a tree or a bunch of trees is not going to solve the problem. But what other research shows is once you start planting trees, you start to identify as a person who cares about the environment. And then you're more likely to do other things that help the environment. And so often we need to help find common cause and then build on that and help people have a sense of identity around that positive thing. But instead, we end up in political gridlock. And a lot of people, you know, politicians will say this, that there are people across the political aisle will say, privately, I agree with you, but I can't do that because this lobby group will come after me and I'll get primaried in the next election. So the political system and gerrymandering and all those things, lobbying, has made it worse and harder to compromise. And so we all, every single person listening to this call, we all suffer from a system that's doing that.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's a social psychologist, Jay Van Bavel, and we are talking about the power of groups. And he wrote a book, co-wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Power of Us. Let me ask you, though, you know, what happens when a political group becomes a cult? I mean, what is the psychological shift that happens so that people who are supporters become absolute believers so that the leader can do no wrong? And I will do anything for that leader.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because I did a deep dive into the research on cults for my book. And we have a whole chapter on cult psychology because when people think of groups, they don't think of all the positive things I've been telling you about cooperation and all those good things, belonging. They often think about cults and mob mentality. And that does happen in some cases, though they tend to be rare. But what happens in cults, one of my favorite studies ever was conducted with a social psychologist saw that there was a doomsday cult in Chicago, and they predicted that there was going to be flooding and the world was going to end. But if you believed in this cult, that on midnight on a certain night, an alien ship was going to come to the cult house and like pick you all up and save all the true believers from the flooding and catastrophes. And so the experimentalist, Leon Festinger, a very famous social psychologist, went in, joined the cult, and he was there with his research assistants in the room when the clock struck midnight. And he wanted to see, okay, when these people were faced with a clear piece of evidence that their cult and belief system was wrong and their group was wrong, would they update their beliefs and leave? Would they be rational, right? And so he was in the room, and of course the clock strikes midnight, everybody's quiet. And then quickly they start to realize, well, that clock must be running fast. The clock in the other room is running a little slower. So it must be the aliens are coming when the other clock strikes midnight. So they all move to the other room and look at the other clock. Eventually that one strikes midnight and no one talks for like 3 hours. People are just silent. Their whole belief system is crumbling because they've like cut off all their friends, give away all their belongings to the cult. And then the leader goes into another room and comes back and says, the aliens have just given me a message that because our beliefs are so strong that they have, that we have saved the world.
Oh, wow.
And so you might think, okay, at this point, this is pretty stupid. But the next day the cult members went out and proselytized and wanted to spread the word about the great work that their cult did. And so that was what happens when people, and this happens in political groups too, is that it can cause so much cognitive dissonance when your leader lets you down or is corrupt or fails. But you're part of this group. And what the researchers found is the two biggest predictors of whether you stuck in the cult after this was if you're a deep, true believer and if you had a sense of community. And those two things make you cling to the belief and to the group, even when it's proven wrong. And so you see that with political parties and political groups. And when they go wrong, it's often because people are deep believers and have lost their sense of open-mindedness and connection to reality. But also when it has this sense of belonging that's being filled for them, makes it almost impossible for them to believe, to leave. And so they start rationalizing all the crazy, stupid things that are happening.
I mean, creating a sort of, I won't say different reality, a kind of unreality out of what they've been fed and told.
Yeah. Yeah, they start to, our minds can fill in all kinds of gaps. We can spin and reinterpret things in ways that make us feel better, that can rationalize our need to be part of this community. And so that's why these senses of belonging, when they go to these really extreme cases, you know, you think of like the Jonestown cult, they all drank Kool-Aid and killed themselves. And they knew they were going to be killing themselves. There wasn't any deception about it. And they fed it to their kids. And it just becomes incredibly hard to break from that and dissent from that when you're deep in these.
Well, we're almost out of time here, and I want to know how people do break from that and descend from that. I mean, people are capable of change and doing extraordinary things in their lives. Is there something momentous that will shift someone from this ideology or belief in a dangerous organization or group?
Yeah, I'll say two things. The first thing is, if you're a leader, what you ought to be doing is creating a psychological safety and a culture of dissent. And teams that have that are much more likely to be successful because it allows everybody to speak up. They reach better decisions. They're more connected to the evidence. They are more creative. So we can create cultures and communities that are the opposite of cults by fostering, making it easy for people to speak up and dissent. So you should look for those. If you're going to join a new company or organization or political party, look for places where that's the norm and where it's easy and where it's valued and where it's respected. And that means even if one of my favorite studies finds groups that have a dissenter reach better outcomes, even if the dissenter is wrong. And you're thinking, okay, why? That doesn't make sense. Well, it's because the moment someone dissents, it becomes easy for everybody else to speak up. And that's how you get the best ideas. And I will say one other thing about dissent. This is from my co-author, Dominic. He did this research when he was doing his PhD. A lot of people think dissenters are the people who don't support the group. But his research finds it's often the people who care most about the group. They are willing to dissent because they worry the group is going wrong. And so when you hear dissenters in your group, you should support them and try to embrace them because A, they'll help your group reach better outcomes, but also because they're often the person who cares most about the group to begin with. And so it's really important because they're willing to take all the risks because throughout history, we treat dissenters terribly. We call them devil's advocates, heretics. All of these things often end up with bad treatment, but they're often the most valuable members of society, especially if they genuinely care about the group.
So look for dissent and look for people that are willing to challenge the status quo.
Yeah, and then try to support them in various ways. Amplify their voice, support them. And I would say the last thing, if you have a family member or friend who's in a cult or a cult-like political party or conspiracy community, which are becoming big in the last few years, like QAnon is a big one.
Yep.
What I often say is don't cut them off, because there's going to be some point where they might be ready to give up on the cult. And if they have no other source of belonging, no other social support, because they've been told to cut off everybody else, and you think they've gone too far and been crazy, they will have, it'll be very hard for them to leave.
We got to.
And it's kind of having a friend in an abusive relationship. You got to have, give them a ladder out.
We got to leave it there. Jay Van Bavel, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks to you as well.